Och kväll gav Lebed klartecken att förhandla om en politisk lösning av konflikten, men att Jeltsin gjorde klart att Tjetjenien måste förbli en del av Ryssland. Det tillfälliga uppehållstillståndet för den unga peruanskan Monica Barrantes och hennes snart tvååriga dotter Evelyn går snart ut. Den sista augusti ska de utvisas till Peru. Igår eftermiddag greps Monica Barrantes mor av polisen i en lägenhet i Stockholm. Modern saknar uppehållstillstånd och har hållit sig gömd i Sverige för att vara nära sin dotter. Gripandet är ett första steg att kunna utvisa alla tre till Peru, säger anhöriga som Ekot talat med. Det blev upplopp i Paris igår kväll efter att polisen stormat en kyrka där omkring 300 avvisningshotade västafrikaner hade förskansat sig. Demonstranter kastade stenar mot polisen som svarade med att använda tårgas. Omkring 20 människor uppges ha blivit skadade under våldsamheterna i Paris östra utkanter. För att få fart på bostadsbyggandet i Sverige överväger bostadsutredningen ett extra investeringsbidrag på 10% av byggkostnaden för flerfamiljshus, erfar Ekot. Utredningen diskuterar också ett riktat stöd till barnfamiljer för att de ska kunna bo i större lägenheter. Villaägarna får behålla ränteavdragen som idag, men i övrigt ska staten inte subventionera småhus enligt de förslag som bostadsutredningen ska ta ställning till i nästa vecka. Ytterligare ett amerikanskt militärflygplan har störtat, den här gången i ett ökenområde i delstaten Arizona. Samtliga fyra ombord på planet omkom. Det var den fjärde flygolyckan i USA bara den senaste veckan. I torsdags kraschade två mindre militärplan i Maryland och förra lördagen störtade ett fraktplan i Wyoming. Och USAs federala polis, FBI, har bekräftat att man hittat mikroskopiska spår av ett sprängämne i resterna av det passagerarplan som kraschade utanför New York för drygt en månad sedan. Men FBI betonar att upptäckten inte entydigt kan påvisa att en missil eller en sprängladdning skulle ha orsakat explosionen. Stockholmspolisen har gjort husrannsakan hos en motorcykelklubb och funnit omkring 15 kilo sprängmedel. I en kista låg det över 100 stavar med sprängdeg. I handicap-OS i Atlanta har Sverige tagit två nya guldmedaljer, detta genom sportskytten Thomas Johansson och simmaren Petter Edström. Vädret idag, Götaland och Svealand får molnigt och lokala regn eller...
September the 1st, 1939. Hitler's Wehrmacht invades Poland. 25 years after the Kaiser's army swept through Europe for the first time in this century, the world is at war once again, and Germany is the cause. Of German militarism went back decades. By the end of 1918, Germany was a conquered nation. Although the war had not been fought on German soil, in defeat the country was occupied by foreign troops and subject to the dictates of the Allied powers. The victors met in the Chateau of Versailles near Paris. Hundreds of representatives from 27 nations crowded into the Hall of Mirrors to decide the fate of Germany and redraw its borders. In the same grand hall where the first emperor of a united German nation had been crowned, the victors now met. After months of discussion, in May 1919, the Allies announced the terms of the treaty, a settlement to be imposed on the defeated Germans without discussion or negotiation. Under threat of renewed Allied force, it was signed by the new German government established at Weimar. The Allies seized millions of tons of armaments and industrial equipment. Germany was forbidden military aircraft, tanks, or any offensive weapons whatsoever. Trucks, locomotives, big guns, airplanes, many of the choicest fruits of the German war industry were picked by the Allies and shipped out of the country. The victors also directly targeted private industry. Battered by the guns, planes, ships and submarines produced by German industry during the war, the Allies decreed that they would dismantle Krupp and other companies. Thousands of machines were destroyed under Allied supervision, and some factory buildings were gutted. The Allies forbade any military production, but they did allow Germany to keep an industrial infrastructure. This would prove invaluable when military production restarted. German frustration at the Allied actions erupted, and not just against the foreign victors. Ominously, talk had begun that the German armed forces didn't really lose the war. They were stabbed in the back by traitors within Germany itself. In much of the popular imagination, these traitors, especially Social Democrats, Communists and Jews, were blamed for Germany's humiliation and for the social and political upheaval which followed the end of the war. Reflecting popular discontent, the president of the German National Assembly sounded a warning to the Allies.
Our enemies have laid before us a treaty which by far surpasses the fears of our greatest pessimists. The hardships of this treaty will create a generation in Germany in whom the will to break the chains of slavery will be implanted from their earliest childhood.
The treaty called for the dismantling of the newly formed German Air Force. War planes were taken apart and workers busied themselves by smashing motors and sawing apart aeroplanes. Tough restrictions were imposed. Motors could not exceed 60 horsepower and planes could not fly faster than 170 kilometers per hour or higher than 4,000 meters. But although the Allies had forbidden military aviation, young Germans continued to take to the air. Gliding, unfettered by any restrictions, became an expression of German independence and national will. The rolling hills and valleys of central Germany became a training ground for a new generation of heroic pilots and aeronautical engineers. Among the young glider pilots were men who would play major roles in Germany's military future. People like Willy Messerschmitt. A teenager during the First World War, Messerschmitt had been raised in the glider culture, drafting, designing and building the motorless planes which were the glory of German aviation after that war. He was only 17 when he built his first glider, the S5. At the age of 25, still a student at the Technical University in Munich, Messerschmitt founded his own company to produce passenger and sport planes. Messerschmitt's early aircraft were extremely successful. Praised for their technical sophistication and simple design, they exemplified the trend towards lighter, faster machines. In the 20s and the early 30s, however, demand for aircraft was weak. Messerschmitt remained among the smallest of the German aircraft companies. While thousands gathered to watch the young glider pilots, the secret rearmament of Germany had already begun. Though adamantly opposed to communism, the generals of the Weimar Republic turned to the Soviet Union. There, the German army worked in secret with the Soviets, far from the Allies' chafing restrictions and prying eyes. German industry soon followed. The Junkers Company constructed an aeroplane and engine plant in Russia as early as 1921. Throughout the 1920s, the Germans and Soviets collaborated on the construction of new aircraft and the training of pilots. Political instability, economic chaos, and high unemployment characterized the early years of the Republic. And at the same time, German resentment towards the victors continued to increase. The new democratic government established at Weimar was forced to pay huge reparations to the British, French, and Italians. The country's wealth was used to reconstruct Allied economies, and the German people resented it. The economy had not yet recovered from the effects of the war, and the payments were partly financed by printing money. In 1922, the rate had already dropped to 400 marks to the American dollar. Then later that year, additional territory was returned to Poland, and French troops reoccupied the Ruhr industrial district. The bottom fell out of the German economy. Pessimism about the future was pervasive, and signs of instability and poverty were everywhere. In January 1923, there were 7,000 marks to the American dollar. By August, a million, and it took over 1 billion marks to buy one loaf of bread. And by November 1923, one US dollar was worth 4 billion marks, with no end in sight. Eventually, it would cost 71 billion marks to mail a single letter. Ordinary Germans had savings of a lifetime wiped out within a few weeks. All over Germany, charities collected second-hand clothing for those out of work. Only speculators and the wealthy industrialists were spared. By 1925, the young republic was already in crisis. Paul von Hindenburg, the most popular field commander of the German army during the First World War, was elected president. Almost 80 years old at the time of his election, Hindenburg had no clear political or social program, but he was a genuine folk hero, associated with moral virtue, stability, and military rectitude, a reminder of a time when Germany was respected, even feared, by the rest of the world. The politician who benefited the most from the chaos and frustration during the Weimar Republic was Adolf Hitler. Hitler had the votes of millions of Germans, given freely and without pressure, who admired his strong leadership and unapologetic nationalism. In 1933, after more than a decade of steady political groundwork, the Nazi Party had become the choice of millions of Germans, and Hindenburg appointed Hitler as Chancellor of Germany.
Make a space on your dance card and save the last waltz for the Saturday stack. Spin through the sky on a wave of whirligigs in gyroscopic motion. The complete history of how revolutionary idea just took off. Choppers, next Saturday from 4 on Discovery. So you think it will never happen to you, but somewhere in Britain there's a burglary every 25 seconds. That's why your home needs protection with a security system from Extra Watch. Extra Watch puts your home in line for the emergency services 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, so we can take action fast. Systems start from just £99 fully installed, including personal attack alarm. And with a monitoring charge of just 99p per day, that's a small amount to protect your family and home 24 hours a day. Call 0800 955 999 for further information. That's 0800 955 999. Extra Watch. Security for life.
New Carte d'Or strawberry ice cream from Wall's. It captures all the fresh, delicate taste of real strawberries. Just ask any strawberry lover. New Carte d'Or with real pieces of strawberry. Carte d'Or, taste more.
Why didn't you tell me you were inviting them?
I wanted to surprise you.
surprise me then.
I eat Aunt the pasta twice just because she is so nice. Angelina. Angelina. Waitress at the pizzeria.
When you walk through the global village, make sure you carry a global currency. Over 200 million people in over 200 countries speak MasterCard.
Pizza delivery!
Back up.
Every language speaks MasterCard.
A continuous dull ache that used to get more intense whenever I did any physical activities.
Very miserable. At times, very miserable.
Stiffness, backache, poor circulation, even tension and stress. There's a way to help relieve that pain with Bolson Hydrotherapy, the massaging action of air and water. The unique mattress fits easily into your bath without plumbing and connects to a powerful air pump. Jets of warm air stimulate blood and oxygen supply, making muscles supple and relaxed. Soon you will benefit from improved circulation and a relaxing sensation of relief and well-being.
The balsam has been marvellous. It's had a marvellous effect on my quality of life.
Oh, it's absolutely great. It's wonderful. Everyone should have one.
Relieve your aches and pains with Bolson Hydrotherapy. For a brochure, phone free now on 0800 42 43 44.
This fella makes calls from payphones without putting money in. He makes calls from other people's phones and never pays them a penny. And so do his children. How do they do it? They use a BT charge card. With one of them, any call made away from home is automatically charged to your home phone bill. Call this number now and get BT charge cards for your family. They're free and worry-free.
Let Extra Watch protect your home 24 hours a day from just £99. Call now on 0800 955 999.
Wild Things. Discovery examines the extraordinary world of nature. Take a look at some of the wildest species known to man. Witness their struggle for survival in their own wild habitat. Wild Things. Weekdays at 7 on Discovery.
The nation was tired of the Weimar Republic's years of political and economic instability. In the young and charismatic Adolf Hitler, they saw prospects for stability and prosperity, a chance to regain Germany's place in the sun. The new Chancellor had inherited over a decade of Weimar rearmament, and the hidden agenda of the 1920s became an open priority under the new Nazi regime. By 1935, Hitler had decreed the establishment of universal military service. The size of the German army would be increased to 500,000 men, five times the size stipulated by the Treaty of Versailles. Orders were issued by the Führer, reorganizing Germany's armed forces and creating the Wehrmacht, with Adolf Hitler as commander-in-chief. In addition to the military, the Nazis recognized the importance of forming alliances with both workers and industrialists. They understood the need to create both jobs and profits. At the same time, Hitler also cultivated the wealthy industrialists. The Nazis promised to eliminate the communists and expand military production. As one of the largest private companies in Germany, Krupp played a leading role in the Nazis' plans for further rearmament. Gustav Krupp headed the family business when Hitler came to power. Only 20 years before, he'd answered the Kaiser's call when the First World War began. A generation later, his eldest son, Alfred, had been groomed to succeed his father as head of the huge industrial conglomerate. Now, in the interests of their business and their family, they both put their considerable support behind Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. In an extraordinary gesture which reflected the high regard that Hitler felt for the Krupps, the Führer himself even paid a personal visit to Villa Hugel, the Krupp family estate. The company's own historian wrote,
"As soon as the Hitler government was established, it called on the firm to make war material again, and the call was answered without so much as an hour's delay. It could be done because the capacity had been preserved and the know-how kept alive throughout the dead period, with the whole family fortune at stake."
Even before Hitler came to power, Krupp's Germania shipyards had begun work on destroyers, escort boats and cruisers. Smaller ships, including light cruisers and minesweepers, were built as well, virtually all of which were forbidden by existing treaties.
They launched her on April Fool's Day, 1939, from the slipways at Wilhelmshaven.
Construction of the Tirpitz began in 1936. She was named after Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz, the man who'd commanded the Kaiser's fleet.
We hear the voice of Frau von Hassel, daughter of Admiral Tirpitz, christening the last and most formidable of Germany's battleships.
Befehl des Führers und obersten Befehlshabers der Wehrmacht taufe ich dich auf den Namen Tirpitz.
Tirpitz was one of the most destructive and powerful warships ever launched. Called pocket battleships, the Tirpitz and her sister ship, the Bismarck, were twice as large as the battleships which the German fleet had launched just 20 years before. With 42,000 tons of Krupp steel, she seemed virtually unsinkable. Hitler had also publicly repudiated the restrictions on military aviation. Hermann Göring, a World War I flying ace, was a close confidant of Hitler. He'd been named President of Germany when Hitler came to power, and now, in 1935, he was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the new Air Force. Many of the young men, who, like Willy Messerschmitt, had been piloting gliders only a few years before, ended up in Germany's new Air Force. 20,000 officers and men and over 1,800 aircraft were available at the inception. The World War I biplane was obsolete and the new Air Force needed a new plane. Göring immediately put manufacturers to work designing new warplanes. Once again, Messerschmitt proved himself a brilliant aeronautical engineer and rose to the challenge. The ME-109, a lightweight single-seat fighter, was years ahead of both international and domestic competition. In its design, technical sophistication and performance, the ME-109 had no rivals. Hitler's drive for military might was accompanied by a battle for the hearts and minds of his own people. In preparing for his 1,000-year Reich, Hitler realized that the young people of Germany were the key to his success. In the year he gained power, the Führer immediately organized the German youth movement into two branches, for both boys and girls, regarded as integral parts of the Nazi Party and a civic responsibility for families. From a young age, children were exposed to pure Nazi ideology. Every German boy had to register with the Reich Youth Headquarters. His family background and racial purity were investigated. If he passed the requirements, he was admitted to the junior division. The ceremony took place on the Führer's birthday. Hitler had a vision of what he wanted for the future of Germany's children, and an ideal image of a new race of young German men, swift as the greyhound, tough as leather, and hard as Krupp steel. He said he wanted a violently active, dominating, brutal youth. Youth had to be indifferent to pain, with no intellectual training. He asserted, knowledge is ruin to young men. Young people were the foundation of Hitler's vision for Germany's brilliant future.
Eine freudige und fröhliche Jugend. Ihr sollt nicht mit
You should not walk with grief-stricken faces. You should look at the world with laughter, and you have every reason for that. Because this world, your world, our people, our Reich is more beautiful than ever.
Young Germans, the bright future promised by Hitler seemed securely within their grasp. First, Austria was incorporated into the greater German Empire. Then, Czechoslovakia and Poland. City after city fell to occupying German forces. Conquest followed conquest, with hardly a single setback. For the rest of Europe's children, however, the future was less bright. In advance of the Nazi invasion, the children of Paris were evacuated to the countryside. France fell quickly, along with Belgium and Holland. Facing little or no resistance, the German Blitzkrieg succeeded in taking virtually all of Western Europe. For the young men of the Wehrmacht who marched into Paris, it seemed a world of limitless possibilities. Hitler's promise of 1,000 years of German mastery over Europe seemed on the verge of fulfillment. On the Western Front, Germany now turned its attention to a recalcitrant Great Britain. The country felt the full and focused power of the German war machine. weeks, the scream of sirens filled the air as thousands of German bombers pummeled London and other British cities. The bombing raids were just a harbinger of things to come. On Germany's northern Baltic coast, on an island called Peenemünde, a group of men were working on one of the war machine's most frightening technologies. Manned and unmanned rocket research had started years before the war, driven by young enthusiasts like Werner von Braun. At the age of 25, von Braun had been appointed technical director of the German Army's Peenemünde Rocket Research Center. Within a year, he'd produced a self-propelled rocket which could carry an explosive warhead 11 miles. Constant testing accompanied the research, and the fledgling German effort saw its first successes. Before the war, von Braun and others had already begun the development of long-distance combat rockets. Von Braun, always a brilliant technician, was already at work on even more dangerous variations. But Hitler demanded quicker and more visible results, and the technical progress made by von Braun and his team was slow, punctuated by dramatic failures. The impact of von Braun's rockets was to be far in the future. For the Allies, however, even more terrifying than the prospect of bombs from the sky was the hidden terror at sea. The most dreaded weapon in the German arsenal early in the war was the submarine. They struck their targets in silence and without warning. At the beginning of the war, the German Navy had 57 submarines, called U-boats, after the German word Unterseeboot, or underwater boat. Duty on a U-boat was among the most prestigious in the German military. U-boat sailors considered themselves a breed apart, a specially elect group completely devoted to the ships on which they served. By late 1942, the Germans were able to operate approximately 100 submarines simultaneously in the Atlantic. They travelled in large groups called wolf packs, with dozens of subs sometimes attacking a single convoy of Allied ships. But the camaraderie of the U-boat sailors came at a cost. Life on the boats was hell. A cramped space, constant noise, the smell of diesel fuel, mould and sweat, and the endless ritual of U-boat life. Stand watch, eat and sleep, punctuated by the terror of attack. And it was dangerous. Of every four sailors who went to sea, only one would return to port alive. But as the war continued, it demanded ever more sailors, soldiers, and pilots. Agricultural and factory workers headed off to the front, and labor became the Reich's most precious commodity. But as country after country fell to invading German troops, new sources of labor replaced German men in the fields and on the factory floor. Voluntary recruitment of foreign workers began almost immediately, and many signed up. But the labor needs of the Reich quickly outstripped available supply, and the Nazis turned to force. Fritz Sauckel was the man who led the brutal hunt for workers across the territories occupied by Germany. Appointed in 1939, he was Hitler's chief lieutenant in the mobilization of labor for the war machine. As the war continued, the geography of Sauckel's hunt for slave labor was established by the pattern of German occupation. First, Czechoslovaks and Poles in 1939, Romanians in 1940, and Yugoslavs and Russians in 1941. Jews remained a special case, however, not within Sauckel's domain. The obvious first choice for laborers was occupied Poland. The massive deployment of civilian Polish workers, mostly for agriculture, began early in 1940. The government ordered the supply and transport into the Reich of at least 1 million agricultural and industrial workers. At least 50% were to be women, as a replacement for German workers who'd left for the front. For public consumption, the Nazi regime offered a rosy picture of the Polish workers' prospective life in the Reich.
Foreman, are the Polish people good workers?
Yes, Poles in general are very good workers.
But the reality of slave labor was different. At first, many Poles fled into the forests or simply failed to answer the conscription orders. But the Germans quickly took measures, for the most part through intimidation and brutality, to assure worker cooperation. Protection squads rounded up hundreds of workers at a time off the streets, or pulled them from cinemas and public squares. Polish workers began streaming into the Reich. As the war expanded, the need for workers seemed unlimited, the supply inexhaustible. In the final months of 1942, an average of 40,000 Russian men and women civilian laborers were shipped into the Reich each week. But even with conscription of foreigners and POWs, the war machine required more workers. And there was another, more sinister source of labor still untapped. Dachau was the first concentration camp, opened only 2 months after Hitler became Chancellor in 1933. In a society where no dissent was tolerated, traditional jails were insufficient to house the prisoners taken by the regime. Dozens of camps were constructed across Germany and the countries it had invaded. The camps were operated by Heinrich Himmler's SS, the Nazis' internal security force. Liberals, communists, Catholics, homosexuals, political dissidents, anyone whose words or lifestyles were opposed to the beliefs of the Nazi regime was subject to incarceration in a concentration camp. Jews were a special case. In addition to the concentration camps, there were special extermination camps, factories for slaughter on an industrial scale. Jews arriving at Auschwitz were immediately separated into groups, the criterion being fitness to work. From the beginning of the war, industrialists and the security services were in basic disagreement about the usefulness of Jews in the concentration camps. Exploitation and extermination were not easily reconcilable aims. Prisoners, Jewish and non-Jewish, were delivered to the concentration camps daily. The arrival of every individual was carefully noted, a questionnaire completed for each person. The prisoners were taken for washing and disinfecting. Their heads were shaved. Uniforms were issued. An elaborate classification system of triangles and inverted triangles of different colors was used to identify prisoners. From the beginning, inmates considered fit were assigned to SS construction projects. various SS economic enterprises and private firms. The regime at Dachau was strict. Work, food, work, and then more work. Wake up at 4 a.m., roll call at 5:15, then work from 6 a.m. to noon. A few minutes for lunch, then back to work until 6:30 in the evening. Another roll call at 7 p.m., lasting about an hour, and lights out at 9 p.m. During winter, wake up was pushed back an hour to 5 a.m., and working time was dawn to dusk. Typical daily rations consisted of bread and substitute coffee for breakfast, turnip or cabbage soup for lunch, and for dinner, an ounce of meat or cheese alternating with a bowl of soup. As the war continued, meals were increasingly meager or entirely absent. But the work continued. Labor in service of the Reich was considered a purifying duty, and the front gate of Dachau was emblazoned with its motto, Arbeit macht frei. Work makes you free. Meanwhile, Hitler's plans had been unexpectedly interrupted. In 1942, his armaments minister was killed in a plane crash. Albert Speer, already close to Hitler, became the new minister of armaments and munitions. Speer was an architect by profession, only 26 when he joined the Nazi Party. In the early 1930s, he quickly became a favorite of Hitler's. The Führer appointed him General Architectural Inspector with a mandate to turn Berlin into a capital which would befit the 1,000-year Reich. The young architect went to work immediately, designing a grandiose scheme for Berlin and other cities throughout Germany. Now, several years later, Speer quickly proved himself a capable technocrat. As army, air force, and marine losses mounted, Speer was responsible for ensuring that German forces maintained their ability to wage war. And he did a consummate job, against all odds. Speer inherited the armaments ministry at a time when Germany's fortunes had begun to change. By early 1943, the German advance eastward had stopped. After a long and bloody fight and the loss of thousands of lives, Axis troops surrendered at Stalingrad. Losses of airplanes, ammunition, land vehicles and guns were also enormous. The strains on German armaments production increased further, with fewer and fewer German workers available to fulfill the orders. Companies like Mercedes-Benz, Messerschmitt, Krupp and others were desperate for additional labor. Speer's job was to keep the troops in the field supplied with the armaments they needed to fight a losing battle. Early in 1944, the tide of war having turned against Germany, Armaments Minister Speer made a direct appeal for the help of SS Chief Heinrich Himmler. Civilian and POW workers no longer covered the labor shortfall. More concentration camp labor, including Jews, was needed. But officials of both the Nazi Party and the SS were intent upon destroying the Jews, not pressing them into the state workforce. Small numbers of Jewish concentration camp inmates had been employed in various projects even before the war began. Now, the Nazis' final solution was modified to embrace extermination through work as well. By early 1944, with the majority of European Jews already killed in Nazi death camps, the Nazi war machine had run out of options. Desperate for labor, even Jewish labor, thousands of Jews and other racial enemies of the Reich escaped the gas chambers and joined the war effort. In 1944, after the Nazi invasion of Hungary, Jews once more returned to German soil. 108,000 Hungarian Jews were shipped to Germany to be used as slave laborers. The group was divided into contingents of 500 men, much in demand by private German industry. Working closely with the SS, Germany's largest companies exploited slave labor on a huge scale. They set up their own external sub-camps for Jewish and non-Jewish concentration camp laborers.